six. Andred.
Yes Music Podcast. 12 True Summers.
Produced by Jeffrey Grisellius, Joseph Cottrell and Ken Fuller, this is Yes Music Podcast episode 600 with Trevor Rabin.
Hi, this is Trevor Rabin and you're listening to the Yes Podcast.
Welcome to episode 600 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. You can always get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. Here we are. Mark is with me for episode 600. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. What about you?
Oh, pretty good. 600. It's a celebratory day, isn't it?
It is. It certainly is. 600 episodes and more than 12 years, actually. I wonder what we were all doing 12 years ago. Not what Yes were doing. They were promoting their new album, which was Fly From Here. Goodness me. Wow. That seems like a long time ago, doesn't it?
Yes, many moons ago.
Yeah, so we're going to celebrate our 600 episodes today. And a very special guest that we're going to have on later in the show is going to be none other than Trevor Rabin, which we'll know from the start of the episode. He announces the show at the start, as I'm sure you have heard. But before we get into some things to do with 600, there is another very exciting thing which has come up this week, hasn't there, Mark?
Yes. A little while back, a longtime member and associate and friend of the show, John D., contacted me about something very exciting. He, as you know, he's a collector of, you know, bootlegs and, you know, rare shows and stuff like that, as I am, of course. He contacted me that he had gotten in possession the full 1978 Wembley show in fantastic 24-bit like resolution from the BBC archives.
Which means that
this is not anything that's been broadcast. This is not like the broadcasting one. Like most people, when you get this bootleg usually and you find it, you know, it's from the radio. Most people recorded it from that. And there's always kind of radio compression and stuff like that on it. But this is the, you know, non-broadcast like version. It's like the actual tape that's from the BBC. Tape. So we've been sending files back and forth. He sent me a couple of them and just for, you know, discussion points of what I thought of it and stuff like that. And I even took a little tackle at doing my own little master of one of the songs. I believe I did the Siberian Kitru, the opener.
Yeah.
Just to compare and to see if it was worth tackling with a, you know, a full-fledged mastering studio. I'm sure John would go to like a full blown one to do it properly for the if it was possibly released, which is what I'm trying to get at here. Long story short, is that John is really hoping to get Warner Brothers to release this as a proper release, possibly a box set even from this time period. And we're hoping that you, the 5% out there listening, will, you know, start yapping about it, talking about it, and Warner Brothers will notice the discussion and the positivity about it, and hopefully they will take great interest in it, because it would be definitely much better than the singles album that they released just recently. I'm sure that more people would have interest in this 1978 Wembley show than any singles record.
Yes, absolutely right, and particularly for me, because, of course, this was on the Tuamotu, and it was one of the first concerts on the Tuamotu, and people like Dave Watkinson, our great friend, was at the show and remembers just how wonderful it was. And of course, I've written a book, haven't I, about Tuamotu, and I include a review of the Wembley, the BBC Wembley, but only the low quality version that's available on the internet. So this really would be a fantastic opportunity. So as you say, what John D has asked is, there are many posts about it all over Facebook. So if you're a Facebook user, then please do go on there and add your voice to the many people who've already said that this is a fantastic idea and we need to support it. If you're not on Facebook, then similar things are happening, I believe, on X.com, formerly known as Twitter, and in other places as well. So anywhere that you are online, then do drop your voice into the conversation about this. And if you're not online, then just leave a comment on episode 600 of the Yes Music Podcast and we'll pass those on to to John D. So this really would be fantastic. It's in a week of more excitement for Yes, because we do have the details released of the Yes album box set. So that's coming out. But what we need to do, and that's great, don't get me wrong, that's great. And there are some very interesting aspects of that we will come back to do a proper review of it at some point. But this certainly would be something remarkable, because we have no proper recordings from around this time, or actually quite a few different times in Yes's live history, as we've discussed. Isn't that right, Mark?
Yeah, that's true. There are some gaps in the live, catalog, as I guess you could say, or the collecting aspect of it. I mean, you know, if you go online, you can always find something from some time period. You know, somebody, you know, puts on their, I have, you know, fantastic 74 recording of Topographic Oceans. And then you turn it on, and it's all like, you can't even make out what they're playing. It's like, okay, that's a great recording. So, you know, high quality recordings are few and far between. And, you know, hats off to John for pursuing this and, you know, actually getting the BBC to release this to him to pursue it further. I mean, obviously, he did mention that he is going to be in contact with Warner Brothers. And I think he has been to some degree already in contact with them.
Mm.
So this is a good thing, people. You know, let's support him with it and let's, you know, back him. And if we, you know, make enough noise about it, then who knows? Maybe he might be able to curate some other fantastic recordings, because there are other ones out there. We were also discussing that as well. We were comparing recordings that we had in our own collection, and there was a few of them that I sent to John that he was actually surprised about how good they were. So there could be a possible look at some other things in the future.
Yes. And the great thing about this one, of course, is that it's from a proper recording. So the BBC made this recording using their, I'm assuming, using their normal recording process, and therefore it is extremely high quality in the first place, and, you know, will rival or even probably surpass the quality of Yes songs. So that is really something to look forward to.
Well, let me put it to you this way. I have heard it, you know, not in its entirety, but quite a bit of it. And from what I've heard, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's much better than Yes songs. I mean, we already know that there were issues with Yes songs, blah, 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 blah. And that's why, you know, the Progeny set came out and that, you know, took care of that. But like somebody also posted on Facebook already that there's been a lot already done with Close to the Edge. I mean, there's almost overkill with the amount of stuff that Close to the Edge has done, not only live or, you know, studio stuff as well. So it would be nice to move on to another era of Yes stuff and focus on that, like this, for example.
Yes. An official release of this would be brilliant. So do add your voice to that. All right, then. So back to 600 episodes of the Yes Music podcast. Crikey, looking back, do you know, I can't imagine what initially me and then both of us have been banging on around about 600 times. It's absolutely incredible. And very few podcasts get to 600 episodes and 12 years. And if you go back those 12 years, it wasn't long after the whole concept of podcasts started. So it's, you know, it's a milestone we should celebrate, isn't it, Mark?
Absolutely. I mean, looking back at it, it was funny this week when I knew that we were going to be doing this, I kind of went back to episode 1, 2, and 3 and listened back to them. And I was like, wow, like, and it's great because, you know, the way you started, it was very interesting going through the records at first, you know, and those episodes were, you know, shorter, like, you know, a little bit more concise. Hmm. And then you started going on to, you know, different letters of the alphabet and attaching Yes stuff to it. And, you know, and then you had a couple of your early guests on and it really kind of blossomed, I guess is a good word to use from that. And it's interesting because I know I've been on the show with you for a long time. And what I tried to do is try to discover where I started in with my, you know, my reviews.
Yes.
And I tried to discover where I was actually first on with you. So I don't know if I've discovered that yet. I've been going through them all one by one by one, but you know, there's 600 episodes, what there will be. So there's quite a lot to go through. And so if you're a new listener and you've just joined us at episode 600, man, you have a lot of stuff you can go and listen to.
Yes, and it's fascinating now to have a whole history of the podcast, of the show, that you can go back and find out what some of the news was, you know, 500, 600 episodes ago. It really is an interesting chronicle to look back over the history of Yes, the history of music, the history of social media in some ways, and all absolutely Fascinating. Oh, and just before we go on to the next part, I want to thank very much Miguel Falcao, who has produced two absolutely brilliant episode 600 celebratory jingles for us. So thank you very much indeed, Miguel.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so what we thought this time, though, and we've done some milestone episodes in the past, episode 500, for example, and all that sort of thing back in through the years. But this time we thought, rather than focusing on the show, we would use the 600 episodes to do something really, really worthwhile and something for the benefit of lots of people in the world. So what I came up with, after reflecting on recent events, for example, the concert in aid of, and to remember John Wetton, who died from cancer. Chris Squire died from a rare form of cancer. And my father, in fact, died from prostate cancer. So what I came up with the idea of was to fit in with our 600 episodes, launch a fundraiser for Prostate Cancer UK. And it's going to be, I'll tell you a little bit more about it in a minute. But before we do that, I thought it would be good to have a think about some of the reasons why prostate cancer particularly is a top priority in men's health. All right, so this is what Prostate Cancer UK say on their website. It says, Prostate Cancer UK's top priority is funding research to stop prostate cancer killing men. We're investing millions to find better treatments and better tests that can spot fast-growing cancers early and could be used in a screening program to save thousands of lives. So this is for the benefit of all men everywhere, not just in the UK. The charity just happens to be based in the UK and is local to me, so that's why I chose it. Now, what they've got, though, is a little sort of poster or infographic, and it's got some amazing statistics on it. So, Mark, would you like to read out the first statistic on that little infographic?
Sure. So the first statistic is as follows. 74% of men cannot correctly identify what their prostate does.
Hey. Well, that includes me.
And me.
Yeah. Well, fascinatingly, it's not a good thing, but because my father died from prostate cancer, that means that I think it's four times more likely to die from prostate cancer myself and to have prostate cancer, which does, obviously, it's not a good thing. It frightened me. And my son, William, has been badgering me for years, actually, to go and find out, to go and have a test and to find out whether I'm clear at the moment. And I did go recently and, fortunately I am clear at the moment, but it's something that I should be doing regularly. And I have to admit, it's quite a sobering thought. I don't really know what the prostate does. And it's not the kind of thing we usually leave comments on the show notes about, but if you can help us out there with that, then put the answers on there. I have to say that the process of getting my prostate checked was not fun. It was not fun at all, particularly as when I went in to talk to my GP, just generally about what I should be doing in terms of checking up on my prostate, I didn't realise that she would say, well, just get up on the bench here and I'll check it now. So I wasn't quite prepared. But perhaps that was a good thing in a way, because that meant that I wasn't worrying about it and just got on with it. And, you know, if you think about some of the processes and examinations and so on that women have to go through, my wife, no exception, and all sorts of people for all sorts of reasons have to go through, then it was very quick, very easy, and not that uncomfortable, really. So I would recommend everyone, particularly men over 50, to go and find out if they are clear at the moment. So what about a second statistic then?
All right, so on to number two, which is, now let me just make sure I see this clearly. I don't want to misrepresent anything.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So 3 in 5 men don't want to bother their GP without symptoms, but they may not have any.
Yeah, so I think that's really important. The funny thing about prostate cancer in particular is that you don't know if you've got it. So generally, there are no symptoms. That is something I have read up on, particularly when I found out that I was at increased risk. So you could have an issue even though you don't know about it. So I think the general advice is that, particularly if you're over 50 and a man, that you go to your GP and ask their advice. Is it something you've ever found out about yourself, Mark?
Well, it's interesting that you just mentioned that, because the other day I was, you know, I get a lot of stuff in the mail. Like, you know, I buy records and stuff like that. And, you know, I get different things in the mail. And I went in the mailbox the other day and I saw this letter there. It looked like a government sort of letter. I was like, oh, what's this? So I opened it up and I was like, oh, like, you've just turned 50. Time to get your prostate looked at. I'm like, oh, no.
Yes,
I knew this day was coming. So, you know, I can already see the doctors rubbing their hands in excitement to take a look at my prostate, I'm sure. So.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's good, though, you know, that you've had that. Obviously, Canada are quite proactive and asking you to come in to do that. I don't think I had any kind of communication from the NHS in the UK, so perhaps something that's something they should do. All right. Mm-hmm. So what about the next one?
And this is an interesting one here. Only 54% of men realize prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men in the UK.
Yeah, wow. That's it. I certainly hadn't realised that at all. I mean, presumably that's fairly much the same across the world. I don't know, but certainly 54% of us didn't realise it was the most common, and that includes me. Absolutely right. So it is something we really need to know about.
Well, I would say that we're probably aware of that here in Canada, hence why I got this letter.
Yeah.
Because if it wasn't that common, I'm sure that they, you know how the government is, they you know, they love spending money, but you know, on health stuff like this, I'm sure that, you know, it would be in their best interest to keep the populace healthy. Mm. So if it wasn't a concern, I don't think they would be doing that. So
yes, indeed. So yes. And in fact, the next one, I think, is connected with this, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so. So the next one says, 1 in 2 men think they'll be invited for a test if they're at high risk. But the truth is they won't be.
Yeah, okay. So maybe that does apply to the UK. But yes, I had to find out myself that I was at higher risk. And otherwise, I just wouldn't have known. And the next one is an extremely sobering figure.
Yes, absolutely. The next one reads, 79%, and that's a pretty big number, 79% of men underestimate how many die of prostate cancer. The reality is over 12,000 men dying every year in the UK.
Yeah, okay, so that's a, you know, in a way it surprises me that there isn't more information and education about this. So 12,000 in the UK, presumably you have to multiply that by many times because of the much larger population in the US, for example, and in Canada and across the world. So we're talking about multiple thousands, tens of thousands, you know, presumably millions across the world, dying every year from this disease. And I do know that if you find out about it earlier, then the treatment can be much more effective. So it's definitely worth considering these statistics that we're talking about today. And let's have the final one then.
Yes, and this is an interesting one because I think this also applies to not only cancer but to other diseases as well, and that is, Four in five men don't realize a man's ethnicity influences his risk of prostate cancer.
Okay. Again, not something I know a lot about, so I'm going to have to look into that as well. Yes, quite a few diseases, and my wife works in the NHS, although she works at the other end of things. She works in maternity, so she sees people at the start of their life. But
yes, but that's a good place.
Yeah, but certainly ethnicity plays a part in the way that she cares for women and their babies as well. So again, something I need to go and find out about. Is that something that you realised, Mark?
I didn't realise that about prostate cancer, but, you know, having, you know, dealt with other things within my family, like diabetes and stuff like that, they also say that that's a factor as well. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, they said that I'm not sure if it's, they said African-Americans also have a higher number of diabetes. I'm not sure if that's 100% correct, but I remember that there were certain other diseases or conditions that are, you know, more, you know, attached to different ethnicities more than others, right?
Right, okay. Yeah, so something else we need to look into as well. All right, so those are the rather worrying statistics. So we are encouraging everyone listening who is a man, particularly over the age of 50, to go and get checked. And I apologize if you weren't expecting this kind of thing today from episode 600, but I think it's a really good opportunity. Now, as I said earlier, I was going to say something about exactly how we're going to do this. So I've set up a page, and if you go to yesmusicpodcast.com, you'll see the link on the show notes for this episode 600, a link straight to our Just Giving page. And you can go there and you can pledge some money to help us reach a target. And what I thought might be quite neat is if we set a target of £600, and that's because I'm in the UK, so think dollars or whatever, £600, if we manage to raise that, then Mark and I have undertaken to do a live episode, the first ever live episode of the Yes Music Podcast. And the nice thing about that will be that we'll actually be able to play some Yes and Yes-related music on that, because it's live. We can't share music in a downloadable podcast, but we could do if we did it through a live streaming platform. So there we are. That would be very exciting. And of course, we can invite our friends on to celebrate 600 episodes and to celebrate reaching that milestone of money raised. So just to whet your appetite, I thought, Mark, we ought to come up with perhaps three songs each that we would play if we have this opportunity to do a live episode. So what about one from you, Mark?
Well, me being, of course, a relayer man, you would know that it would be definitely something from that album. And of course, being that my favorite song is Sound Chaser, I would definitely vote for that song to be played.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And no surprise, everybody will just be shouting at their speakers. You won't be surprised that the first one I'll play is something from Tormato. Mm. Now, my feeling is that most of the songs on Tormato are quite short, so perhaps I could play the whole album. But no, that wouldn't be fair. So, but certainly on the Silent Wings of Freedom, definitely, and perhaps Madrigal. But yes, something from Tormato. What about something which you would play, Mark, which isn't actually officially by the band, but is very closely connected to the band?
Closely connected to the band. Well, I think that solo albums would be closely connected to the band. So I would maybe play something from Fish Out of Water, which is my favorite Yes solo record. Sorry, all you Elias people. But Fish Out of Water is definitely my favorite. So, you know, anything from that album to me is fantastic. Mm. But, you know, Silently Falling, I think, is a great song.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Fantastic picks, of course. I think for my allied or related one, you know, I might play that video, the audio from that video of Circa doing the Yes medley. That would use up quite a bit of the time we've got, because that's long enough. But yeah. I just absolutely love that. So who have we got? We've got Tony Kay is playing on that. Alan White plays on that, doesn't he? Billy Sherwood playing on that, and Jimmy Horn plays the guitar. Well, yeah, wow. That's brilliant. So certainly I could see myself playing that. What about another one? Yes or Yes related. That's fine for the last one.
Well, I'm gonna say something that, you know, I don't feel this is controversial, but maybe to some of the 5th percentile, they might kind of roll their eyes to this. But I would definitely hammer my hand down on my table hard to demand, Kevin, that we play something from the new album, Mirror to the Sky. Yes. Like Luminosity, I think, is a song I've been really on lately. I've been listening to that song quite a bit. I really enjoy that song. And damn it, that's a good album. People have really enjoyed it, and it charted really well, you know. So I think that it deserves some extra look at. And the only reason why I'm kind of making a big stink about that is because, as you know, Yes is touring.
Yes.
Right? They did start off playing All Connected and Cut from the Stars on the tour, but they decided to cut All Connected. And I was like very disappointed that they did that.
Yeah.
I blame Steve Howe. But anyways, I think that more from the new album should be played, in my opinion.
Absolutely right, yes. Oh, there are so many things I could choose, aren't there? But what about our friend Oliver Wakeman and his contribution to Yes? Mm. And From a Page, something from a Page would be lovely. Would be absolutely love this play, I think, because the more prominence we can give to that mini album or album, whichever way you want to look at it, I think would be great.
I was just going to say that it's very ironic that you mentioned that, because that little box set been in my car now for the last 3 days. I've been listening to that album and I absolutely love it. Yeah. You know, just such a fantastic release.
Absolutely is. Release, as they say. So what we'll do is, we definitely want to get to this £600 target, and then we will do the live episode. However, if we manage to exceed that, then perhaps there might be some other ideas. So, you know, if we exceed it by twice as much, for example, then we could do an extra specially long. It might turn into a bit of a marathon, but, you know, if we do manage to raise for this fantastic cause even more money, then we could think about other things that we could do. So invite listeners, for example, on would be lovely to play their songs that they would like to play. And some of the guests that we've had over the years as well would be fantastic.
And what would be great is if some of the listeners were to come up, they can even, you know, bless us with some of their, you know, stories of Yes, how they get into the band, you know, what were their favorite concerts. And, you know, me and Kevin, we're thinkers. Okay. We have a mind that's always working. So believe me, if we get to that number, you will not be disappointed, my friends.
Absolutely right. We could have a great time, couldn't we?
Yes.
All right. So do put your comments on the show notes for this week, suggesting some things that we might play or suggesting what you might talk about if you came to join us on the first ever live episode of the Yes Music Podcast after 600 episodes. And all that remains now for us to say is, I really hope you enjoy when Trevor Rabin came on and spoke to us to help us celebrate 600 episodes. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Yes Music Podcast, 600 episodes.
Helping us to celebrate 600 episodes of the Yes Music Podcast, we are delighted to have Trevor Rabin with us today. Hello, Trevor.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And Mark is here as well. Hi, Mark.
Greetings, Kevin. Greetings, Trevor.
Hey, Mark, how are you, man?
Good.
Excellent. All right, then. Well, let's dig into this. So we have a wonderful friend and listener whose name is Dave Watkinson, and he wants to know, do you remember your first UK solo tour in 1979? Because he went to that.
Oh, my goodness. Steve Hillage, I'm not mistaken, I was opening for.
Ah, Steve Hillage, yes, absolutely. So that was right before all the other things we'll be talking about today.
Wow, that's amazing. And, yeah, he was a really nice guy to be opening for. He was always he actually came and listened to the shows and would comment on them, and was always helpful. Mm. Nice guy. Mm. I have no idea where he is, what he is, what he's doing. I haven't spoken to him since the tour.
Nice. So there's also another longtime listener named John D. David and John D also met you at a rehearsal when the band you formed with Chris, Tony, and Alan White was called Cinema. One of the stories from that time, pre-90125, is about a long song called Time. Do you remember that song and what happened to it?
I remember it very, very well. It was a very long song, and we spent a lot of time rehearsing it. And I remember the engineer who was kind of mixing the band at the time at the rehearsal was Nigel Luby, and he recorded it. And I remember asking Alan if he had a copy of it many years later. And he said, you know what, I've heard it somewhere, but I don't know where it is. somewhere in the ether is a copy of it, unless it's in the trash. But I haven't heard it for so long, and I don't even remember. I have a basic idea of how the sequencing of the song went, but I couldn't play for you right now.
No, indeed. So this was before John Anderson and Trevor Horn became involved with all that and the band changed to Yes. What did you think of that move at the time? Did you actually want to be part of a 70s prog band or a new birth of it and play its repertoire live on tour?
No, definitely not. I mean, the idea was I'd written all these songs. It was either going to be a solo album, and then Phil Carson, who you obviously know, Phil suggested I'd send him some of the music because I'd been dropped by Geffen Records. And I was looking for a deal. And I had a couple of offers, one from RCA, a fellow by the name of Ron Fair, who went on to be a really great executive, but was a good musician. And I remember him calling me saying, there's a smash hit on your songs, and the cassette I got. And it was Own Over Lonely Heart. Mm. And he was the first guy to recognize the promise of Own Over Lonely Heart. But, my choice was I went and rehearsed with Alan and Chris. I thought, yeah, this would be fun. And I thought it was going to just be a new band, largely based on these songs that I'd sent to Phil Carson. And thereafter, he sent out to Chris. And we started rehearsing, and 9 months later, there it was. Yeah, it was not something I intended to do. In fact, when the idea came to call it Yes, I was very apprehensive about it. I thought, well, it's a new band. It's got nothing to do with the old band. However, we finished the album, well, close to finish the album, and then John heard it, and there was discussions, and John came in and sang some stuff, and I thought it just sounded great. And at that point, the record company said, oh, well, now we must call it Yes, because they saw it as a great opportunity to sell records.
Yeah, of course.
So that's when it became Yes. And Chris was very generous in that. He almost apologized to me, saying, look, we're going to go out as Yes. The record's doing well. We're going to have to play a lot of some of the old stuff. We'll do the whole new album, but we're going to have to do some of the old stuff. And there's a number of songs we have to play, but then for the rest of it, any other songs we choose from the old catalog, you choose.
Nice.
So, I'm not imposing too much on you. So Chris was very generous with it, but, and he also said, the way you approach the old stuff, approach it like it's a new song. So, and in that way, and it was very smart of Chris, because he said, we talked about it, and he said, in that way, there'll be no kind of sudden change in style, and you'll put your own slant on the old stuff. And so it started sounding a little cohesive, like one band.
So moving a bit forward, I actually saw the Union Band live here in Toronto. I remember that show. It was actually my very first Yes show I ever saw, which was at the Sky Dome in Toronto here. Looking back now, what did you think of the whole Union project?
Rick, who I'm very, very close to, Rick, I remember Rick saying to me, whenever I think of Union, I call it the Onion album because it always makes me cry. And that's a typical Rick comment. It was put together. I mean, I remember getting a call from Clive Davis saying, oh, I'm doing this album with ABWH, and it's their second album, and, it's going fine and everything. Do you have any songs for it? And I immediately, knowing a little bit about Clive, I read that into, we have an album that has a problem, we need a single. And that led to me, it Lift Me Up and Miracle of Life and songs that we provided. But it was such a separated thing. I never heard the Union album at all until we'd handed in the songs that, as they say, Yes West handed in. It was two completely separate entities that had little to do with each other, but Clive picked up on Lift Me Up and Miracle of Life, and that became, you know, the singles and or the single and the flagship single song of the album.
Yeah.
But as far as it being a band, it was Union was not a band. The Union tour became a band. And some would say reluctantly, but it turned out to be a lot of fun. And it, I think it, my brother said to me, he saw it and he said it was one of the best Yes shows he'd seen. So I guess something worked.
Absolutely. Well, we better get on to talk about your new album, Rio. And the obvious question is, why has it taken so long to create another band record?
Well, it's not that long. It's only 34 years, right? You know, it's really a peculiar thing because I, you know, left the band in 94 and wanted to get into film scoring, wanted to work with orchestra. And to cut a long story short, I got into it and not very easily. It took some, you know, maneuvering. And but eventually, having got into it, I thought I'd do 5-6 movies, get back into doing an album. And then if I'm lucky enough to get some more movies, I'll do another one or two. And here I sit 30-odd years later, looking to my left, and I've done 50 movies and dozens of other film things. So in a way, the bad news is it's taken 30-odd years to get to do this album. But I think the good thing is, you know, doing the tour with Rick and John stretched my vocal muscles. So that muscle was in shape to do this album. And it felt like the first album. You know, everybody who is a musician, they spend their life to do their first album. Then once the first album's done, immediate it's like, okay, if the album does well, okay, we need the second album. And you've got to do that quickly. And that's always a pressured thing. And you have to live with it and work within the structure. But with this album, because I had no pressure on me to do anything, but there was just no pressure on any level. And I just went into it with absolute love and compassion. And I don't want to sound too glitzy, but I really loved making it. And it was an easy album to do in that it just flowed. There weren't too many moments. I mean, there were moments of total anguish, but they were always worthwhile moments and led to something positive. So it was really an enjoyable project. And I hope the next album, which I want to do as soon as I can, has the same kind of freshness that I felt I was approaching it with.
Great. Absolutely fantastic. So one thing I'm very, very anxious to ask you this question. So I'm curious about the album title. When I first heard that it was going to be called Rio, it made me think back to the 1980s and Duran Duran, actually. So what was the reason for the title? I'm guessing it, Duran Duran had nothing to do with the inspiration for the title.
Oh, a total Duran fan. I mean, it's all about that. actually, Rio is my first granddaughter, my only granddaughter. And it all happened at the same time. And the album started and my granddaughter was born. So when the album was finished, it was like, I'm just going to call it Rio. I actually asked my son and my daughter-in-law and they said, yeah, that's cool. So that's kind of, there was nothing beyond that.
That's a better reason than calling it after Duran Duran, that's for sure.
Yeah, right.
So what do you think you've learned from all that soundtrack composition which you've done, which has affected the way that you approach the music on Rio?
Yeah, that's a great point. It definitely has. And I think working so closely and so intricately with orchestra for, you know, 50-odd movies, and getting so close to the musicians, I mean, you know, 70, 80 of them, and becoming good friends, literally going to dinner at their homes. And it became like this massive band, you know, because I did most of the scores in L.A. I did quite a lot of scores in London, but mostly in L.A., and I became very close to the musicians. And I think that sensibility infiltrated this album quite a lot, you know, utilizing orchestra and even utilizing, you know, the instruments I use and play outside of the orchestra, orchestrating those instruments as opposed to just playing in a band kind of thing.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So the range of styles and approaches on Rio is certainly eclectic, from electric soloing to finger-picking acoustic guitar to atmospheric strings and multi-layered vocal harmonies. Were these things that you felt you needed to get out of your system?
Yes, and that's a great point. And the fact that I felt no pressure, I didn't have a record company. I was just doing the album pretty much for me. I don't want to sound too selfish, but just initially. So, you know, consequently, I went to all different places. I've always been a fan of, you know, bluegrass and country picking chicken stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I went there on a couple of tracks and even to the point of using a B bender pretty extensively. Yeah. And you know, the thing I worried about was there's a lot of different styles on the album, but then, you know, once I put the producer cap on and listened, I thought, you know what, this is actually, it's going to be cool because my voice sounds like my voice. So, you know, hopefully that and, you know, whatever my guitar style is, hopefully those things will glue it all together.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. One of the interesting things about the album is that some of the songs have influences from and lyrics about your homeland, South Africa. So was it important to you to say some things about that country on this record?
Yeah, you know, I did that on my last album and I've done it for a while, but because it's a great passion of mine and I have a love for the place. And I was such a huge, I mean, my biggest hero in the world, I think, one I would say would be Nelson Mandela. And I had the good fortune of playing at his concert in South Africa, the benefit concert, and meeting at his residence and eating with him. You know, I was like a kid in a headmaster's office. I was just so in awe of him. And then now on these songs that comment on South Africa, I look at South Africa and I see, you know, particularly Egoli, which is a city of gold, being Johannesburg, basically. I see this almost like a kleptocracy there. You know, it's gone from this incredible vision of Mandela's becoming a rainbow nation and not having to go through the trauma of bloodbaths and everything. And it's seeming like that. But then, you know, once Mandela passed, things started changing. And right now, I worry about it. Mm. Not as much as I worried about it when apartheid was running. That was way more traumatic. But I think they got some real problems, corruption and et cetera.
Yeah. So the new album is fantastic. I absolutely love it, both songwriting-wise and sonically speaking. How important is keeping current with music technology when it comes to making your albums?
You know, my son is a producer, and he works a lot with new young artists. So that's my attachment, if you like, or my ears hearing new stuff on the radio or, you know, kind of thing. But as far as stylistically, the album has absolutely no attachment to trying to be current or anything, although I'm always trying to be on the cutting edge of technology. So technology is definitely part of what I do.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the production tricks, if you want to call it that, that you do that we enjoy is this doubling of an electric guitar lead with a classical guitar, like you did on Shoot High, Aim Low. And we were just interested what the inspiration for that was.
Well, it's funny with Shoot High, and you know, there's that, I guess the first solo is a very fast pentatonic kind of thing. I just thought it sounded so much more vital on acoustic. I played it on electric and it just sounded like just a guitar player playing fast as opposed to an emotional piece of music. And, you know, I've kind of always liked to integrate the acoustic with the electric and, the the less heavy sounds with the more heavy sounds and softer sounds, and orchestrate the guitar rather than just play it and play solo on top. And that's, I think the idea of conceptually of what I did on Shoot High and Low is definitely on this album.
Fantastic. So here's one question that when I heard we were going to be talking to you, this is one of the questions I was really getting excited to ask you about. And this is in regards to your guitar, that Fender Stratocaster that you own with the fantastic airbrushing job that you did on it. To me, it's one of the most identifiable guitars I've ever seen in my life. I'm very curious if Fender America, USA, or any branch of Fender guitars have ever asked you if they were interested in doing a signature model of that guitar.
You know, people have talked to me about it, but I never took it any further. I've never spoken to Fender about it. I think some years ago they asked the idea of a signature model, and I don't even remember the year even, but I wasn't really interested because there was no allowance for saying, well, I'd love to do this on the guitar, so change this or that. It's no. The only change is that your name will go on it. So that didn't interest me. So I've done some signature guitars, especially Alvarez, which I love that guitar. I use a lot. And that's on this album a lot as well. But the Fender's a one-off.
Fantastic stuff. Right, just a little question about ARW. The time you spent with them looked like a lot of fun. And I saw you in Birmingham, UK, and I loved the concert. It was brilliant.
I loved that show. I remember it, yeah.
Do you miss playing with a band when you're concentrating on film scores?
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, Rick and I always talked about after union, the idea, our bucket list should always include us working together, and that's what led to ARW partly, you know. Yeah, that was definitely an exciting moment to be playing again. Although I didn't miss it while I was doing the films because I was so busy and so involved in it that I never really even thought about it.
Mm. I think on the expanded version of this album, you've put that track Fragile. And the original idea for that was for it to be an ARW song. Is that right?
Well, it's actually started out some years before that. And that's the version that's on the album right now, that original version. Right. But there was a point where, you know, management and there was a lot of we got to do some music. We can't just keep touring and not having a record. But we'd never really planned to do that, although we'd been getting together and, you know, talking about stuff and writing ideas. And so that was really something that, okay, for the next tour, to promote the next tour or the next leg of the tour, we should have a song. And I just put that forward. John sang it. Rick played some great keyboards. And that was really the idea. I wish it was a better story, but unfortunately, that's about it.
Interesting. So if you could give one piece of advice to up-and-coming audio engineers about mixing songs, what would it be? Because, I mean, obviously, the first time I heard Talk, I thought that was a sonic masterpiece and something I'd never heard that good of a recording like that ever. So I'm curious on your advice for up and coming people who mix songs and albums.
Oh boy, that's such an interesting question. I've never thought of it in terms of that, but I would say keep your ears fresh. Don't go down any rabbit holes because I've done that and your ears get fatigued and suddenly it just becomes a mush, as opposed to keeping it clean and separate and really, really get into understanding and working with reverbs and delays and compression and EQ. I mean, obviously those are the four main ingredients for what you do when approaching a sound mix. But yeah, and just use your ears and your instincts.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the time we've got, Trevor. It's been absolutely wonderful to speak to you finally. Only 600 episodes into the podcast.
Oh, congratulations on that. My goodness.
Yes, thank you very much. And we've spoken about you and your music many, many times before. So thank you very much indeed, Trevor.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. It was fun talking to you.
Brilliant.
Great. Thanks, Trevor.
All the best. Cheers.
Whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is these go to 11.
Just before we go, for the 600th time, here are the YMP producers and half the patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Joseph Cottrell, Ken Fuller, and Jeffrey Cresselius. And all of the Yes Music Podcast patrons, so sit back and relax, are as follows: Jim Morrison, Gary Betts, Barry Gorski, Martin Kelberg, Lind, Mark James Lang, Bob Martellotta, Dem, Chris Bandini, Mark Baggs, Dave Owen, Terence Sadler, Fergus Cubbage, Stephen Raw, Dave Watkinson, Brian Sullivan, Miguel Falcao, Brian Harris, John Pickles, Alan Begg, Steve Perry, Todd Dudley, Paul Hales, Steve Rode, John Holden, Fred Barringer, David Hayden, John Cowan, Simon Barrow, Steve Dill, William Hayes, Lobate Scarp, Tim Stannard, David Pannell, Paul Tomei, H.B. Peterson, Declan Logg, Michael Handahan, Doug Curran, Rachel Hadaway, Craig Estenes, David, Stephen Lamb, Scott Colombo, John Thompson, John Parry, Steve Scott, Robert Nasa, Jeff Bailey, Jeffrey Mason, Robert Vanderveer, Jamie McQuinn, Michael O'Connor, and Guy DeRome. So thank you, as always, to all of those patrons and producers. If you'd like to help them keep the lights on here at YMP Towers, then do head over to the new Patreon. All looks different. Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or just click on the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week for our 600th episode. Thanks so much for listening once again. We do hope to be back next week for 601. And in the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved via Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. And remember, please do take part, if you possibly can, in our fundraiser for Prostate Cancer UK. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.